Real families, real farms, real food. Welcome to Arizona Agriculture Connection with Maricopa County Farm Bureau. My name is Nicole Clements, Executive Director, and I'll be your host. Maricopa County Farm Bureau is the voice of agriculture in a community that thrives on the dichotomy of urban and rural agriculture operations. This podcast is a home for farmers, ranchers, food lovers, prospective agriculturalists, and those looking to connect the food on their plate with the farm that it came from. As we take an inside look at agriculture in Arizona, we will delve into topics like ag technology, policy, food preparation, and everything in between. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform with new episodes every Wednesday. Arizona Agriculture Connection is hosted by Maricopa County Farm Bureau and sponsored by Paloma Ready Mix and Materials, a proud supporter of agriculture and our communities. Be sure to subscribe and share your favorite episodes with your friends. For more interactions, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, at Maricopa County FB. Now let's discover some Arizona agriculture. All right, welcome back, Arizona Aggies, to another very special edition of Arizona Agriculture Connection. Today, I'm very excited to have Miss Joanna Allhands with us, one of the, well, I guess the newest team member at Arizona Farm Bureau, and maybe a name that you might recognize from her days at the Arizona Republic.
Yeah.
Exciting. So give us a little bit about your background, kind of how did you get into journalism, and then what led you kind of to Arizona?
Yeah. Well, so I knew from a young age that I wanted to write, or that I wanted to be in some kind of communication field, but I didn't fully know what that was going to be until my freshman year in college. I had I just went around to all of the news outlets in my hometown and just cold called these people and were like, hi, I'm a young worker and I will work for free. And so, yeah, like I went to the radio stations, I went to the TV station, I went to the newspaper, and I ended up getting several offers, and the newspaper was really kind of the one that I wanted the most, and I got it. So they were like, yeah, come on and, write stuff. And, and so, yeah, that was my freshman year after my freshman year in college that summer. I was there and there was a bombing at our courthouse. And that was the moment where I was like, yeah, newspaper is probably what I want to do. And I haven't looked back. And honestly, it was just one thing where one door led to another door that led to another door. I didn't have I sort of had a grand plan. I knew I wanted to come out here from the time that I was actually a freshman in college. I learned about the Pulliam Fellowship at the Arizona Republic. And I had come out, my grandparents moved out here, there were snowbirds out here when I was a freshman. And I came out here, it was the first time I'd ever been to Arizona, and I fell in love with it. And I was like, this is where I want to be. This is the newspaper I want to write for. It will happen. It was like that scene in Wayne's World, it will be mine. Oh, yes, it will be mine. And so I ended up getting the Pulliam Fellowship and came out here and wrote for the summer after I graduated college. And it was right before 9/11, and the economy wasn't great, and there were no job opportunities. I ended up going back. I'm originally from Indiana, so went back to Indiana, ended up getting a job there, worked there for 3 years. But I always kept in touch with the people out at the Arizona Republic, and a job opened up, and I had no expectation of getting that job because I was 24. And people don't hire, especially at that time, people didn't hire kids in opinion writing. It didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But it did. And so I came out here in 2004. I joined the opinion staff at the Arizona Republic, and I was there for 21 years.
That, I think you really manifested that I will be in Arizona, I will write for the Republic. And I love that so much. And if you're Gen Z and you're listening to this, just YouTube Wayne's World. You won't be disappointed.
It's fun.
So with that, and we kind of talk a little bit about career paths and things on this podcast too at times. So that, you had a plan.
And sort of.
You sort of had a plan.
Yeah.
Which is more than some people. But even though it didn't go exactly, how you would hope, right? You took some detours along the way. You still ultimately made it to where you want to be. But then 21 years down the line, your plan changes.
It does. that's life, man.
And so how does that transition feel for you, being at one job for so long and now you're kind of switching gears into
not gonna lie, it was super hard. I think because especially for journalism, and I think, you know, probably farmers and ranchers can, you know, sort of relate to this, is like there's what I call calling jobs, the jobs where it's like it's your calling. You wouldn't do it if it wasn't your calling. And journalism is one of those jobs. And so it's so deeply ingrained in your identity that, you know, when you're suddenly not that thing anymore. And I mean, this came, it was very sudden. I was not ready to leave and it just happened, you know, and that's okay. Like I knew that this day would eventually come at some point, just where the industry is and things and stuff. And so, you know, that's a thing. Like to suddenly be like, wait a second, I don't do that thing anymore. And I wasn't done. And like, so there's grieving. I mean, it took months, you know, just to try to figure out like, who am I and what do I do? And, you know, where do I go? And, you know, I loved writing about water so much. And I know we'll talk about that more, but I was like, is this over? Like, am I done? Like, I don't know. And I literally had no plan. And if you know me, I am a person who has backup plans to backup plans. Like I'm one of those people that thinks ahead a million miles, you know? And so for me to just be out there, like I didn't have a resume together. I didn't have like anything. I mean, it was just like, there were no prospects at all. And I was like, I don't know where I'm headed, but okay. But I'll tell you, when life throws curveballs like that, and it does, life always will throw a curveball. It's okay. You can roll with the punches and you can still get to a place where like you're good. So yeah, it's hard, but it works.
Absolutely. Yeah. With that, so as kind of a lover of traditional journalism, right? Like I grew up at one point, I was like, I'm going to major in ag journalism, and then realized that the place where I was going to school didn't even have that major.
Oh,
so
no.
I was like, I guess I'm not doing that. But when we see this transition, okay, because we've seen it all, right, from, you know, our kind of age group, I don't know, I'm millennial.
I'm a little older than millennial, but yeah.
But same time span, right? So we've seen the technology go from, you know, bag phones to flip phones to the first iPhone and smartphone and now, you know, where we're at today. But we've seen the evolution from, you know, when the first social media was Zynga and MySpace, and then you had to have a university email to even have a Facebook,
yep.
Which I did early because I was taking dual credit classes in high school.
You were
and
an
had
early
a university
adopter.
Email. Don't tell anybody, I guess. But and so, but we've seen the switch, and I feel like the method that people are consuming their news and their journalism pieces, I feel like that switch has happened so rapidly, mm-hmm. because we kind of have watched it evolve and evolve and evolve. And then it, to me, almost felt like overnight, like, okay, well, now we're no longer getting newspapers. We're not reading magazines. We're not doing, everything is on the internet.
Right.
Everything is on social media. How does that change what you do?
Oh, totally. I mean, I can remember, you know, coming in as a young journalist when I started here in 2004 full-time, you know, at the Arizona Republic, and like what my job was like then versus just how it changed over just a smattering of years, you know. And really, I think things were changing, things were moving. Everybody knew, like, we have to figure out something. We have to be able to keep doing this. How do we keep pace? And there's no silver bullet. There's no right answer. If there was, people would have already figured that out, you know. But I think the big thing that really happened, it was the 2016 election, just completely changed the game. You know, it used to be, especially for opinion writing, because there used to be sort of this understanding that, like, people have different perspectives. And, you know, there's a back and forth, right? There's like this pull and push and pull and compromise. And I come from that really deep background of like, those are things that I really hold dear. And I think we've unfortunately lost that as a society. And it happened really fast. And, you know, I'm not sure that we've really fully figured that out. I mean, one of the things that we've known is like, journalism has become so fractured, right? There's like, it's not everybody reads the newspaper anymore. Everybody even watches TV, you know, that's like, these things don't happen. You don't have these mass audiences. It's all, you know, here and there and here and there. And you just kind of, you know, listen to your tribe basically. And there's not a lot of cross-pollination where people with different ideas can get together. So that's been happening, and that's been happening for a while. But the thing I think that is more recent and to me is more troubling is that you've got people who have just flat out said, I don't get news. Like, they just have completely logged off and said, and I totally get it, especially because I think there was this trend where everybody moved into, well, I primarily, well, it's not everybody, but a lot of people, it was like, I primarily get my news from social media. And social media is so toxic. It can be. It can be so toxic.
Extremely draining.
And everybody, yeah, I mean, you're scrolling. I mean, you know, we have a term for this, right? Doom scrolling, right? You're just, And I think, of course, people have said, look, I don't want that anymore. Like, I have social media accounts. I use them because I have to, but I don't use them in my spare time anymore, just because I'm like, I don't like how I feel when I'm on them. But I think there's been this shift now where there's a lot of people that just, they don't know what's going on at all because they've completely logged off of anything. And so to me, that is the more troubling part. And I don't know how we fix that as a society.
Yeah, but that's, I've been seeing this trend now with the younger, like Gen Z, and they're going analog. They're getting flip phones,
yeah.
And they're saying, I'm over it.
Yeah, and like, I don't blame them.
I was looking up, like, how much is the, can I get a flip phone for? Can I put my phone number on the flip phone? Do I have to get a new number? Like,
right.
That, and we've seen the pendulum swing.
Yeah.
All the way. Like, I feel like we maxed it out. And it's going to come back, and I say that because on a doom scroll on social media, I saw a guy who's now starting his own physical magazine.
Mm.
He's like, we want to hold something in our hands again.
It's old school.
And I'm like,
it's coming back.
I'm cheering for you. I don't know if that, like, I don't know if that's the answer either.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm rooting for you. But with that, like, and like you said, it's fractured. So we end up in our own echo chambers.
Yep.
All day long. And so the news and the media that we're consuming very rarely will break through with a contradictory opinion.
Right.
And agriculture is kind of notoriously bad about that anyway. We love to share our story, but we share it with ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. We want to share our story out with everybody. So with this kind of dynamic, how do you think is best for agriculture to continue this mission of kind of breaking out of our echo chamber and sharing our story with the world?
Yeah, and I think that's a big challenge. And shout out to the Summer Leadership Conference that we were just at. If anybody, I don't know when this is going to air, but, you know, when people hear that, you know, I don't even know if it was recorded, but the tailgate panel that was talking about how do we break out? How do we make sure that we're not so insular? And I think, you know, that's a huge challenge. And I think the big thing, in fact, I've been thinking about that a lot since that conference about, like, so how do we do that? You know, and I think probably the biggest thing is it's all in here. It's all mental, right? It's all deciding, like, I really want to connect with other people that are not like me and that I am going to do the hard work of finding shared values. And I think that's a thing, unfortunately, it's a skill we've lost. But I think that that is the thing, you know, when you have a commitment to say, we're looking for compromise, you know, we're willing to engage with others. And even within the ag industry, you know, there's kind of these little factions, you know, that are kind of here and there, and there can be like little things. And you know, the point that was happening at that panel that everybody was talking about was like, we need to be united. We need to, you know, when we show up and say, here's where we're at, here's what we need to happen, here's, please help you understand what it's like for us. Because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it's like to be a farmer or a rancher, because there's less than 2% of them in the nation, you know. They're just a tiny minority, and there's a lot of people who just don't understand what that's like. And so being able to tell that story, being able to tell a nuanced story, being able to tell a clear story, and being able to just get out there and say, you know, it's kind of like the what the Republican Party used to talk about, the big tent. We need the big tent. You know, there's no tents anymore. I know that's not how politics works, but you know, I think that's the big thing, is just being out there with the willingness to do it.
I could agree with that. Like, no, that you have to, and that's kind of, I think, the scariest part about any sort of storytelling, journalism, social media, whatever it is, whatever the medium is. It's scary because you have to put yourself out there too. And you have to kind of expose yourself to feedback that you may not necessarily want.
And I've heard it all.
And that's tough. And I can only imagine, as someone who's been riding on water for multiple decades.
Well, I haven't been riding about water for multiple decades, but I think I'm closing in on a decade now in water. But.
So how did you get kind of this interest in the water topic? I mean, because everybody knows the water topic in Arizona, right? But how did you get kind of this knack?
So it's completely by accident. Totally by accident. So it was probably about 2017-ish. It was during the whole drought contingency plan thing, and there was this TIF happening between the Department of Water Resources and the Central Arizona Project. And Tom Buschatsky, who is the head of ADWR, the water department, had sent in an op-ed to us at the Republic that was like, they're not playing ball. And like, so, and I was editing that, and I was like, we have, you know, regular editorial board meetings and stuff. So I brought that to one, and I was like, you know, I think something else is going on here. Like, there's something deeper to this. I was like, somebody should go, you know, check it out. And the answer that I got was, yeah, someone should probably do that. So I was like, huh, well, okay, curiosity gets the cat, right? So I made a few calls, and I end up writing a story. I don't even know where that story exists anymore, and I probably would cringe if I read it, because, you know, I didn't know anything. But I realized really quickly that, like, this is the most important issue facing Arizona, because if we don't have water, we don't live here. I like living here. So that was the thing. That's what got me into it. And I just, you know, started making calls and going deeper and getting really nerdy and reading all of these, you know, studies and understanding law and, you know, policy, and just getting super into the weeds about this kind of stuff. Just because to me, it's so nuanced and complex, and because I'm, I don't know, half psychopath, I guess, I really like things that are nuanced and complex. I like stuff that there's no, you know, black and white answer, because to me, that's how life is, right? Nothing's ever really totally just one or the other. There's always this gray area in the middle, and, you know, I tend to see a lot of those shades. So it's right up my alley, you know, because there's never, I mean, people say this, you know, the joke in water is, you know, there's never a yes or no answer in water. It's always yes, but, you know, or no, but, you know, there's always some little exception or something that always proves the rule. And so I like that. I like that. And I like being able to have this conversation where at least some things are becoming more partisan in water, but still, by and large, it's a bipartisan thing. And so it's something where you can bring a lot of people together and find those shared values and talk about compromise. I mean, I was a broken record for that in all of my, you know, columns at the Republic, was just, you know, there's a way that we can figure out how to do this if we're willing to come together and find those shared values. I keep saying that, but I mean it, you know, because there are things that we all hold dear, and there are things that, you know, we can live with and things that we can't. And when you find those places, that's where policy happens. That's where you can find, you know, the space in between where we can live.
It is such an incredibly intricate topic. And the, like, when I think about, for me, like, laying out Arizona's water situation, right? It's like a spider web. Mm-hmm. Because everything is connected, but also sometimes not. And the levels that you have to go through to get anything done, basically. Yeah. So how do you take such an intricate topic that's incredibly complex in by design and also in language, and then translate that into something digestible by consumers?
Mm. Yeah, I think it comes back to what's important, right? What are the things that people want to know? What are the things that they don't understand? You know, and sometimes I do get into the weeds a little bit. I try to stay out of them generally, but like, I mean, you know, the piece that I just did recently explaining the Yuma water situation, totally in the weeds, but totally important because people need to understand why it's so hard for the Yuma irrigation districts to offer up water. And that's going to be something that is so crucial to how we move forward, depending on how deep the cuts are to the Colorado River. And people are going to need to understand that. So that was one of those things. But yeah, I think it's getting into those pieces that it's like, well, you need to understand this because this is how you survive. This is how, you know, cities continue and farmers continue. And, you know, like, I think that's the big thing. And just trying not to use the technical terms. You know, when I'm doing the interviews, I get super in the weeds and, you know, use acronyms and all that kind of stuff. But when I'm trying to explain it to a wider audience, then it's more like just try to explain what it does, not necessarily what the terms are and all that kind of stuff. I think that hopefully, I don't know, maybe people can tell me if I'm right. Hopefully that helps.
It is so complicated. I think every time I sit down to write about anything that has to do with Arizona water, it's honestly pretty intimidating because there's so much that goes into it. Yeah. And, you know, it is very divisive, it feels like.
I think a
lot of the media that we see oftentimes is divisive on the topic, which I don't think does anyone any good.
No, and I think that's the problem, is that there's a lot of demonization that occurs in water. And I get it, because it's like people are thinking about, well, how I use water is the right way. But those guys over there, they're totally wasting water. And what I realized in speaking to a lot of different groups is that actually everybody uses water pretty well. Can we do better? Of course, everybody can always do better. There's more that we can do to save and conserve and find additional resources and things. But when you look down at it and start talking to various groups about what they're doing to save or to use water wisely or efficiently, you know, they're all valid uses and they all deserve to continue. You know, they're going to have to probably do some things differently, but like, we can't completely wipe agriculture off the map in Arizona. We can't wipe cities off. You know, there's economic consequences to that too. You know, everybody's got to find a way to continue to do what they do in this arid environment. And so, you know, that's the thing, is that I always feel like when people can sit down and start understanding, like, okay, maybe you don't use water the same way as I do, but you're still valid. And there are probably things that we can do if we put our brain power together to try to, you know, raise the tide for all the ships. Then, I mean, that's the broken record that I always continue with, is like, you guys got to keep moving. You got to keep, you know, working on those compromises, because that's the only way we survive. If everybody, and that's the thing that like scares me the most about where the Colorado River discussions are happening, is like, everybody is so into me and mine and preserve myself and not you, and the court fights that will result from this will kill us.
Yeah. On that note.
Sorry. I know.
On that happy point.
It's so funny when I talk about water, like, I always get to a point with people where they're like, well, good God. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be like, you know, the person that's like, ah, terrible doom and gloom. But, you know.
I mean, but that's the reality. And yeah, that is the literal state that we live in. And I think that is kind of what it comes down to, right? Yeah. Like, understanding the topic enough to know that something has to be done. Everyone's going to have to give up something. You know, I got a notice from my water company this week that they've applied with the Corporation Commission to raise rates.
Yep.
Double.
Yep.
And, you know, that was always something that was really interesting to me. As someone who also is from the Midwest, you know, I have a couple horses and we use a little bit of water. Not anything drastic, right? But, you know, more than maybe your average household just because horses drink a lot, right?
Yeah.
So prior to moving to Arizona, my average water bill from a public utility, and I was a very rural public utility, but my average water bill was about $150 a month.
Mm.
And it is less than a third of that here.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, I think, one of the most shocking things to me in the first year of just, well, if water is this tight, why is it so cheap?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that comes also with a lot of nuance, and there's a lot of things behind that as well.
Yeah.
But just as someone from the outside at that point, you know, now I think I'm on the inside of Arizona. I think they've accepted me. But from the outside looking in, I mean, that seems like a right off the top kind of question is, why is the water
and then,
so cheap?
Yeah, and the corollary to that that I hear a lot is like, well, water's so cheap and that's why everybody wastes it. And it's like, well, not really. Are there wasteful people? Yes, but not really. When you start looking around at all of the things that we've done, we've actually done a lot more than other places. Like, talking with, you know, some folks from Indiana, where I'm from, they have like no water law there at all.
None.
And the interesting thing is, like, they're starting to have these very early vestiges of problems. And people were like, you know, like, they know that I'm into water, and so they're calling me, and I'm like, you're screwed, dude. There is no water policy. You have nothing right now. There's no protection for you whatsoever. Yeah. Someone wants to come in, because people were getting upset. There's this whole project to like drill and transport groundwater to this industrial area away from farms, and people are worried about that, as they should be. There's no protection. It just doesn't exist. So all of that is to say, like, I know there's this tendency, and it's just a human tendency that we have to be like, well, those guys are idiots over there. Me, I've got it all together, you know. In fact, we've actually done quite a bit here in Arizona. And that's why, you know, having such low water rates is such a testament to, like, for how long we were able to do that. You know, now we're kind of hitting that reckoning, and it's just, yeah, it's a thing. It sucks. I live in Gilbert. You know, I'm not one of the higher water users, and clearly the higher water users in Gilbert are the ones who have been hit the hardest with the rate changes that have occurred here. But I mean, you know, it sucks that I pay way more now. I used to pay like $80. Now I pay $150, you know, and we're like 3,000 and 4,000 gallons a month. We are like nothing. And still, you know, we have a lot more. That's going to happen. Water is going to get more expensive because of supply and demand. There's a lot less of it. And so it's going to be more expensive to convey to us. I don't think people understand that. They haven't gotten that yet. And so there's a lot of people are freaking out, you know. And I heard this once from somebody. They said, like, well, you don't think anything twice about, you know, paying $100 for, you know, Netflix or HBO or insert your streaming whatever here. But $100 for water, suddenly you're like, oh, dear God, we can't have that. And it's like, well, priorities, guys. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not much of a TV person, but yeah, I'd rather have water than Netflix. So,
yeah.
You know, if it came down to it, that's what I would choose. But but I think we see it a lot, too, I think, in kind of all of these life needs, right? So, like, your utilities, your groceries, your rent, mortgage, whatever that may be, you know, fuel, and just all of the things that we pay for to live on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the that bare minimum of what you need to exist as a human.
Yeah. And the cost is up for all those things. And yeah. I think that's the hard thing, is because all of the costs are coming together of all of those things. You know, fuel is way more expensive. You know, prices at the grocery store are just up. They just are, you know, like all of those things come together and people, yeah, you feel completely pinched. I totally get it.
Yeah. You know, we went from journalism to water to groceries, and
that's how I roll.
You know, I love the variation, so hopefully it's entertaining. But I want to take a minute, kind of maybe switch gears a little bit. So you have specified in water for the last decade, right? And you've done a very good job of it.
Thank you.
Good enough job that we actually gave you an award for it. If nobody's seen the pictures from last year, Joanna is our 2025 Maricopa County Farm Bureau Ag Communicator of the Year.
Thank you.
Well deserved.
That was a huge honor.
Yes, we were very glad. And so then when I heard that you were on the team, well, that just makes my day.
Yay.
But how did you transfer that kind of interest in water into an interest in agriculture?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of things. The water issue really translates to a lot of the other issues that are facing agriculture. You know, I said earlier, I like things that are really complicated and complex, and that there's nuance there. And there are so many things in agriculture that are nuanced and complex. And the, you know, layer upon layer of regulation and things that a farmer has to, or a rancher has to navigate just to be able to make a living and put things on plates and, you know, all that. It's the same thing, you know? So yeah, actually I've been really enjoying, I know this is going to sound so nerdy, but I've been enjoying going really deep into issues like, you know, the Bureau of Land Management's grazing regulations and how totally messed up that system is. And I don't think most people who aren't, frankly, in ranching know how messed up that system is. And Forest Service too, with grazing regulations, but just how messed up that is. And, you know, so here we're trying to right it now and fix some of those things, but, you know, does it totally fix it? You know, there's some of that extra, you know, nuance that is in the, you know, the whole debate about, it's regulations are important, but they can only get you so far. You still have to have people, yeah. You know, who can then administer said regulations so you can actually, you know, get your permits and do the management that you need to do. But anyway, so all of that is to say, it's complex and it's interesting, and I think they're the similar kinds of discussions, especially for the future of Arizona as we move into kind of this uncertain place with all sorts of natural resources. You know, I think agriculture is kind of in the middle of that in a lot of ways. And so, you know, it's a key player. And I think one of the things about Farm Bureau that just really heartened me and has for a long time and continued, you know, as once I've joined the team, is just how much they want to bring people together and have understanding and like deep knowledge. They don't just want to be like, you know, here's a talking point, yay, yeah. Move on, you know, like that there's really this engagement and wanting to understand the issue and to have solutions. And like, that's where I came, you know, that's just sort of where I came from. So I think it's just, that's such a, it's such a good thing and it's such an important thing. And I'm glad that this is an organization that is committed to that.
Absolutely. I know that's, you know, that's the whole goal with this podcast in particular is, you know, we have that conversation a lot with other farmers and ranchers and, you know, that's part of what we do here. But the other flip side of that coin that we also make sure that we're aware of is, let's have those conversations with people that have never seen a cow or never set foot on a farm like that.
Yeah.
You know, we want to share that knowledge with them too. And so that's why, you know, we didn't necessarily have like a plan outline for today, but going from journalism, now we're in the weeds on water and like now we're in ag and, you know, maybe a little bit of careers. But I think that, I mean, keeps it entertaining, but also it provides that to everyone. Like, it's not just our farmers and ranchers and not just consumers.
Right.
Like, this is information that everybody needs.
Right. Right. And so, you know, we've kind of danced around the fact that like Okay, hold on. I need to put on my helmet. I'm not in ag. I have not been a producer. You know, like I grew up in the country surrounded by farms. You know, we had land, but we just grew stuff for ourselves. It wasn't like, I'm not even going to pretend that I understand being in that position. But hopefully, and you know, I mean, hopefully if I do things well and hopefully I earn the trust of folks that they can see that, like, I want to tell your story, you know, and I want to translate that story to people like me or beyond who are like, I don't know, I go to the store and buy stuff, right? Like, they don't know what it takes to get all of that there. And so to be able to understand those things and understand the nuances that help create better policy, like, if I can do that, hopefully, like, that's the goal, right? That's living the dream, right? That's the thing. So I'm
yeah,
hoping.
You beat me to it, because I was gonna ask. So
you're not an Aggie.
You're not a farmer.
I know. Sorry, I'm not a farmer. I have these very like I would, you know, we go places and I'm like, oh, if I had like 100 acres, like right over there, like anytime we go anywhere outside the valley, I'm like, right there. Like, I'd like to. Yeah. I have grand dreams of that, but, you know.
Maybe one day.
Maybe.
Yeah. But with that, you have, you know, call it a zero baseline of agriculture experience, and now you're in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. And that is one thing that I've always tried to have that conversation, especially with our young people coming, you know, out of high school into college or trade school or whatever it is that they're doing. If you're passionate about agriculture at all, like, there's a place for you here.
Yeah.
And I think something that Arizona FFA and 4-H programs do a really good job of,
yeah,
is providing an agriculture opportunity for kids that aren't living on a farm or ranch or have access to one.
Right.
You know, for me growing up, that wasn't necessarily the case. Our 4-H and FFA, it was all farm kids. Now,
right,
we were in farm country, and that's just kind of how it worked. But, you know, with 7 million people in Phoenix Metro alone, you know, you've got a lot of opportunity there to expose young people to agriculture,
yeah,
and provide them with an opportunity. But then it's kind of like, once you graduate and you're off to, you know, college or wherever you may be, what does that agriculture opportunity look like then?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm, you know, I'm like, don't leave your passion for the industry, because whatever it is that you're passionate about, there's an opportunity for you in ag with that.
Yeah.
Like, your passion is storytelling and journalism, and now here you are.
Right. And, you know, I did a story not too long ago about the agriculture in the classroom program and what they're doing with virtual reality and taking farms, and not just farms, I mean, they're on ranches, they're on dairies, you know, they did a mining thing, they're going to be doing stuff with like snowpack and forestry and all sorts of things, and bringing those experiences to kids with virtual reality and showing them there are so many more careers than, like, because everybody just sort of thinks if you're in ag, well, you have to be a farmer or a rancher. But there's, like, all these other things that support bringing stuff to our plates or creating fiber for us or, you know, all of those things, that there's a lot more there. And especially, like, in that story, talking with some of our folks from Yuma who have, you know, just been awesome innovators and tech adopters. I mean, they're using AI, you know, to try to figure out when they need to irrigate and all these kinds of things, which is really awesome, because those are probably things that city kids would never think, like, oh, well, I could be a programmer, you know, to help do or analyze some data for a farmer who's super busy and doesn't have time to look through, you know, 10 pages of reports, but tell me what the action item is, you know, all of that backhand kind of stuff. Like, that's this emerging industry that's happening now. And so there's so much more that, yeah, kids can totally do that is beyond what they would think as the traditional agricultural careers.
I think my favorite is the drone operators.
Yes.
Like, that's so cool. I don't know. I would probably not. I was not good at video games, so I'd probably not be
I'd
very
crash
good
it.
At
yeah,
flying
no, I'd be
a drone.
Terrible.
I'm not going to, like, try my hand at that, but, like, that is so cool. That is merging the technology and agriculture for the future. And I think, like, agriculture still sits in this really unique space where we're doing really well at combining these new advanced technologies with a traditional kind of face-to-face manual labor, boots on the ground kind of setup. And it's just, it really is truly such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's room for I'm going to try that again. There's room for you in agriculture, and we need all kinds of kinds. So whatever it is that you're passionate about, there is a job for you. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, with that, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to share your story. And I love that we kind of, hopefully, I think we made it full circle around all the different topics today.
Back to jobs, back to, the things that drive you.
But thanks again for joining us.
Yeah.
Great conversation. Really excited to read your next article. So
all right.
You can read everything that Joanna writes on azfb.org. And links will be posted on our website as well, MaricopaCountyFB.org, and we'll catch you next week.
Thank you for tuning in today, and remember, Farm Bureau has a place for you. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with your friends on socials. You can also visit our website, MaricopaCountyFB.org, for more information and to submit a topic you want to learn about. Remember to tune in every Wednesday wherever you listen to podcasts. A huge thank you to Paloma Ready Mix and Materials for supporting our agriculture producers and this podcast. Maricopa County Farm Bureau, bringing you the stories of real families, real farms, and real food. I'm Nicole Clements, signing off. Catch you next week.